From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. So no one told you life was gonna be this way. Your job's a joke, you broke. Your love life's the other way. Well, if just listening to this music washes you in warm fuzzies about umbrellas and fountains and six friends living in impossibly large Manhattan apartments, you are one of the reasons why Warner Media paid $425 million for the rights to put Friends on its streaming service for the next 5 years. Not to be outdone, Netflix reportedly just paid $500 million to grab Seinfeld. That's almost $1 billion. $1 billion for two shows that first aired 30 years ago. Reruns and reboots galore everywhere right now. The Office, that Meta Funhouse Mirror remake of 90210. Friends, I say the 90s called and wants its TV back. Except we're not giving it back because of the sudden, emotional, lucrative nostalgia rush playing out on devices everywhere. So what is going on? This hour On Point, streaming nostalgia. And you can join us. Are you one of those folks that wakes up at 2 a.m. and taps on your on the Friends stream? Do you watch it? Does it make you? Does it fill you with feelings that you otherwise can't recapture? I also want to hear from the folks who think $1 billion for two shows that don't have any new episodes. I can think of a billion other uses for those $1 billion. And joining us today from St. Petersburg, Florida, is Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic. Eric, it is great to have you on Point. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from San Diego, California, is Crystal Antonio Russell, professor of marketing at the Grazidio School of Business at Pepperdine University. She studies how and why people enjoy consuming and reconsuming entertainment. Crystal, welcome to you.
Good to be with you.
And a little later this hour, folks, we will actually be speaking with the co-creator of Friends, so stick with us for that. But Eric, let me just start with you. Are you excited? Are you coming over with all the nostalgia feels for these shows?
Well, see, I've been covering TV for a long time. I hate to date myself. I started in 1997. So it's been interesting to cover Friends as a contemporary TV show when it was airing, and then to also now be covering 25 years later all this nostalgia for the show. Now, from my perspective, I sort of feel like this is not that unusual. I mean, you know, Happy Days was a classic TV show that was reflecting nostalgia for the 50s. It was on the air in the 70s, and it was reflecting nostalgia for the 50s. So it kind of makes sense to me that now, 25 years after Friends, we would be nostalgic for those shows from the 90s that were big. And the themes of Friends are classic themes. It's about found family. It's about what happens when young people kind of leave their biological family and they create a family of friends, right? And it's amazing to me. I have a 15-year-old son who has watched every episode in every season of Friends three times. there's a resonance to this show and to its themes that is reaching younger viewers, and it follows something that we know about television, that's been true about television almost since the earliest beginnings of the form.
It suddenly makes me think we should have had your 15-year-old on with us, Eric. But Professor Russell
probably would have been more articulate than me.
Professor Russell, to Eric's point, yes, I remember growing up, I was obsessed with syndicated reruns of Star Trek, which was definitely, I wasn't even alive when it first came out, but it did fill me with certain emotions that made me love that show. So is this sort of just a new form of an old set of viewing habits that people have?
I think so, too. I agree that there's definitely some classic human emotions in those shows that make us, you know, happy to rewatch. But I think there's also another element of seeing ourselves and how we've changed since the first time we saw it. So 25 years for anybody's life is a huge chunk of time when you've changed. And so nostalgia is kind of this double-edged sword where you want, part of you wants to go back to these earlier times, and part of you is so glad that you're no longer, you know, yourself, an 18-year-old watching, you know, Friends, that you've grown so much. And so you can appreciate the shows on a different level. And that's not really nostalgia. That's more like like personal growth. So I think that that's also happening. It gives people who have watched the shows 25 years earlier a way to kind of revisit how they were back then and how they've changed since then.
Okay. Eric, what do you think about that? I know you see these shows through the lens of a TV critic, but do you sort of revisit your does it help you mark your own growth as a person?
I think that's what's happening with a lot of viewers. I absolutely agree with that. People are able to – I mean, you know, if you're old enough to have been, a teenager or an adult when the show was originally airing, it will remind you of all of these things that may have been going on in your life when the show was originally first on. And, you know, the fashions are there. There's a lot of jokes about contemporary issues, and it may remind you of some of the things that you were thinking about back then or the issues you were struggling with back then. That's a potent part of nostalgia, is reminding you of where you were whenever that stuff was happening. And there's something about this 20 to 25-year gap in time that in pop culture terms is very potent. Mm. And so we're looking back to the 90s in a lot of different ways on a lot of different media platforms to sort of say, oh, wow, I remember that time. Or, you know, if you're too young to have been alive or too young to have really been aware of what was going on then, it's informative. Again, I think my 15-year-old is learning a lot about the 90s by watching the show, in the same way that I learned a lot about the 50s from watching I Love Lucy or watching reruns of or watching Happy Days.
Yeah. Professor Russell, to me, it feels like there's a 20 to 25 years is an interesting gap of time, right? Because it's essentially the length of a generation. So I remember the age I was when these shows first came out, and I have definitely in those 25 years crossed over into middle age. So when I was watching those shows in the 90s, it was a lot. I mean, it was entertainment first and foremost, but also there were some sort of cultural aspirations there in the television shows. And now I look back and I see them and I think, you know, what of those aspirations have I achieved? What have I not achieved? What, like, looking back makes no sense at all? Why did I even want those things in the first place? So I guess it does help us put a check on sort of how of our own lives.
No doubt. Not only that, but it's also a lens to see how society has changed. Yeah. And I think this is also a lens through which you kind of look at the past, and there might be some things that you miss, but there's probably also some things that are like, whoa, we could not get away with that kind of language today, or whoa, those haircuts. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can be the trivial stuff, but also the more significant stuff that makes you realize whether society has changed in a way that you appreciate or in a way that kind of scares you.
Well, we have an example, a potential example of that right here from Friends. This is from the fifth season of Friends, where Courtney Cox, Matthew Perry, David Schwimmer, Elliot Gould, and Christina Pickles featured in this episode. It originally aired in 1998, and it's a flashback Thanksgiving sequence where Monica, played by Courtney Cox, her weight is played for laughs.
Oh, no, it's cool. You can stay here. My parents won't mind.
No, it's not that. I just don't want to be stuck here all night with your fat sister.
Hey.
Monica, why don't you finish off these pies? I don't have any more room in the fridge.
No. No, thank you.
Well, Judy, you did it. She's finally full.
That's Friends from 1998. Eric, is that cringeworthy now?
I guess it's a bit cringeworthy. I think if they had written that scene nowadays, they'd have been a bit more sensitive to Monica's feelings and this whole idea of fat shaming. You know, I also think when you look back on old Friends episodes, there were a lot of episodes that turned on a sort of gay panic where mm-hmm. the humor was that people thought Chandler was gay, or people thought that Chandler and Joey were gay because they were roommates. And I think they probably would have written those episodes a little differently if they had done them now, too. One of the things that's interesting, and it connects again to this idea that we're looking back on how society has progressed. We're in the middle right now of really looking hard at how we talk about things like people who are overweight, like people of color, like women's issues. How do we talk about them in pop culture? How do we joke about them? When we joke about them, do we make stereotypes about people in these groups acceptable, or do we challenge them? And I think now that we're in the middle of this now, we're in this Me Too moment, we're trying to redefine how we talk about these issues. When you go back and you look at these episodes, you can see, oh, that's, yeah, that's why that's so bad. You know, that's why that doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, that's why that echoes a stereotype or demeans someone rather than lifting them up or, you know, exploring in a more healthy way, you know, why they might have problems being an overweight person surrounded by thin people.
Professor Russell, did you want to comment on what Eric's saying?
Yes, I agree. I think that just like we talked about understanding history, even though it's a 25-year-old history, but I wonder what, you know, today's teenagers watching these shows, it might actually enlighten them as to why we're so sensitive today to some of these issues. And so instead of hearing it from their parents, well, in my days, we couldn't say that, or, oh, those jokes were not appropriate. Now they see it through a show that actually was, you know, happening at the time. So it gives kind of credibility perhaps to some of the themes that they see being addressed by adults, quote unquote, and they might realize, you know, why that changed.
Right. Well, we are talking this hour about nostalgia TV and why shows like The Office, Friends, Saved by the Bell, we're hearing that music right now, are popping up on your devices everywhere, and why people are watching them in droves. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about all that nostalgia TV streaming on your devices, your computers, your phones, your smart TVs, why shows like Friends, The Office, Seinfeld, that really fascinating reboot of 90210, are grabbing so much attention. And we want to hear from you. Are you binge watching Seinfeld? That's not an option that we had back in the 90s. And what is it about these shows that you love so much? Or maybe are you worried that with the flood of old programming on streaming content, is that making it harder to find great new stuff? I'm joined today by Eric Deggans. He is the marvelous NPR TV critic. He's with us from St. Petersburg, Florida. And Crystal Antonia Russell joins us from San Diego, California. She is a professor of marketing at the Grazidio School of Business at Pepperdine University, where she examines how and why people enjoy consuming and then reconsuming entertainment. And let's go right to the phones. Jessica is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Jessica, you're on the air.
Hi, I just have a comment. I'm watching BH 90210, which is obviously yeah. Beverly Hills 90210. And I find it interesting as someone who's entering middle age to kind of see how my contemporaries are aging. I know they're put through a glamorized Hollywood filter, but it kind of makes me feel like I'm not doing so bad.
I know. I was just going to say, it makes me feel better about myself, too.
It does. Thanks, Meghna.
So, Jessica, thank you for your call. And Eric and Crystal, I promise, we'll get back to the 90210 reboot, I guess. It's not really a remake. It's a reboot in a second, because I think it's one of the more interesting ones. But I'm going to ask you both to hang on here for just a second, because joining us from Los Angeles is Marta Kaufman, co-creator and executive producer of Friends, which first aired 25 years ago. Marta Kaufman, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much, Meghna. I'm happy to be here.
So you must be thrilled by how people who were maybe just in diapers when Friends first aired are obsessing about your show again.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome, and I have to say, quite surprising. One of my favorite things about it is when my daughter was in high school, one of her friends, and this was just about 4 years ago, one of her friends said to her, "Have you seen that new show called Friends?" They thought it was a period piece about the 90s.
Wow. Oh, interesting. So, what's your reaction, or what do you think about how popular just these reruns are, when I think I heard that you and your fellow producers decided that you weren't going to reboot the show?
Yeah, we're not going to reboot the show. We can't beat what we've done. A reboot is very, very difficult to do. It's extremely difficult to compete with yourself. And then to not be disappointing on some level. And also, our show was over. It was about a time in your life when your friends are your family, and this is past that time in your life, and the heart of the show is gone. As far as the popularity of shows right now, I think in terms of Friends, I can't really speak to BH 90210,
mm-hmm.
But certainly in terms of Friends, I think it's comfort food.
Yeah.
I think it's like comfort food. It's warm, it's loving, it's funny, and these are characters you want to invite into your home when you're, you know, doing your laundry and cooking your dinner and in bed about to go to sleep. And I think that's how it feels. It's
yeah.
Comfortable.
Well, I want to just play a moment from one of the characters on the show. Really a fan favorite. Here's Phoebe, played by Lisa Kudrow, leading the cast in a rendition of her original song, Smelly Cat, from season 2 of Friends.
Smelly cat, what are they feeding you? Smelly cat, it's not your fault.
A smelly cat!
Marta Kaufman, I'll be honest, it still makes me laugh all those years later.
Makes me laugh, too.
I mean, do you think there are lessons for TV producers today about the enduring legacy of Friends?
You know, I don't know that there is one lesson to be learned, and I don't think there is a formula to follow that will, you know, give another show that kind of popularity. I think we did it at a time when television was much more about appointment TV.
Yeah.
And that has changed quite a bit. So I'm not sure that they'll be able to, in this field of TV, get that kind of attention.
Mm. Well, do you think that TV networks won't try to make this kind of comedy anymore? Or
oh yeah, they're going to try.
Okay.
They're absolutely going to try. I just think it's much more difficult for things to catch on fire when there is so much offered.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to ask you one more question here, and this is actually courtesy of Eric, NPR's TV critic. It's a great question. He wanted to know, what is the unlikeliest person, the unlikeliest person you ever met or heard of who was a Friends fan?
My rabbi.
Why did that surprise you so much?
You know, I guess it's one of those strange interactions where the last thing you expect is to be talked to about your TV show. You know?
Yeah.
So that was pretty surprising. I also had, and I loved this, it was an elderly man, he must have been in his lower 80s, telling me how he went to bed to it every night because it made him giggle.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, Marta Kaufman, co-creator and executive producer of Friends, which first aired 25 years ago and now is having this major renaissance on streaming television, with us from Los Angeles. Thank you so much for joining us today, Marta.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
All right. So Crystal Antonia Russell, let me turn back to you. What did you hear in Marta's view about this particular kind of television, having had a moment? And even if people might try to recreate it, they're going to have a hard time doing it.
What I've heard is whether there's such a thing as a classic in TV production, you know? So we have classic children's books. We have classic novels. Is there a recipe? And I'm trying to figure that out myself in my research. You know, there's some elements that we've heard already, classic themes, human emotions, something that's universal. But there's also some caveats, which is like, is it going to age well? You know, are the characters going to be relatable, you know, down the road? And I think Friends has these elements, many of the elements of classic. And if we can figure out that formula, of course, then, you know, we're golden. But I don't think anybody knows it yet.
Yeah. Let's go to Richard, who's calling from Coral Springs, Florida. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to comment that, you know, even Marta was saying that this new format, before it used to be an appointment television where you would come in and, at a certain time you would see your show. But now it's streaming and you can watch it anytime you want. And what's really great about it is that it allows all these other niche shows from way back when to have a second go around too. Like what I'm watching right now is a Dark Crystal remake. It's not even a remake. It's a prequel of the original Jim Henson Dark Crystal movie that was out. And I'm just loving it, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Richard, thank you for your call. Eric, I wanted to ask you about what both Richard and actually Marta Kaufman said, that there's something about how we used to view television that maybe being, it's not necessarily rekindled, but the feeling about that is. Because I was, our staff this morning, we were talking about this, that must-see TV, that block on Thursdays was a real cultural touchstone. I mean, even for people who weren't, like, intense TV watchers, you would tune in for that stuff and then talk about it with your friends the next day. There was something about that collective experience, which maybe we're remembering how it felt, even though we can like binge watch the shows at any time now.
I guess that's possible. I mean, I do think that TV watching is very different now, which I think is changing how we're perceiving these shows and how we're reacting to them, because people can watch them on demand now. They can watch them whenever they want. They can watch them, for the most part, wherever they want, on whatever platform they want. And that's very different than having to show up on Thursday nights at 8 o'clock every week to see the story kind of parceled out. So I do think that the reaction to some of the stuff that we see in Friends, you know, some of the things we talked about earlier, it's easier to see some of the weird gender stuff, the odd, flashes of homophobia, the weird fat shaming. It's easier to see that when you're watching 3 and 4 and 5 episodes in a row. And so I think our discussion about the show has changed because we're experiencing it in a much different way. Kind of a side note, you know, I saw a very complex show called Justified that was on FX. Mm-hmm. I binge watched it recently. Now that was a show that aired week to week, over 5 seasons, but I binge watched it probably in about 3 weeks. And to see all the storylines compressed and to see everything connect in a way that you couldn't really see when it was originally on the air, it's a very different experience. So I actually think that we're experiencing these shows in a slightly different way because we're able to consume them at our own pace, as many episodes as we want. And like I said, with my 15-year-old, watch the whole life of the show and then go back and watch it again, just like a favorite treasured novel.
All due respect to Eric's 15-year-old, but Professor Russell, I mean, on it, to be perfectly honest, I'm not sure I would ever want to binge watch any of these shows because I think, actually, given what Eric's saying, I'm afraid that I'll come away thinking, God, these were actually not very good, that they were pretty bad. And watching them all together like that, it puts a new, maybe a belated, long overdue but necessary, really critical lens on these shows that we uncritically consumed 25 years ago.
No doubt. In fact, I'll share with you some findings from a project on we call narrative navigation that started as we wanted to understand why people binge watch shows. And what we found is actually because of all the streaming and all the technology that allows us to move forward, backward, that there's all kinds of crazy navigation techniques that people use. Like they would skip an entire season because that was kind of a duller season. Or they would just read online, you know, tidbits of stories, and then they would just kind of fast forward and just watch those little bits. Or they would not like one character, so they would skip all the scenes with the one character. And so it's an amazing new way of consuming. We were very surprised because we really just sought out people that are like Eric and watch, you know, tons of shows back to back to back. But actually, these navigation techniques are giving them a whole different way of reconsuming and then re-reconsuming the show. And they end up with a very different experience than the original one was planned.
It's almost like choose your own adventures with your favorite 90s sitcom. Well, we've been spending a lot of time talking about Friends, but we'll let Ross, Rachel, and all those folks take a break here because I really want to hear a little bit about Seinfeld, which Netflix reportedly acquired for $500 million. So here's a clip from season 4 of Seinfeld, originally aired in 1992, where Jerry and George, Jerry Seinfeld and Jason Alexander, sit at their regular diner talking about ideas for a TV series that Jerry has to pitch to NBC. And George tries to sell Jerry on his great idea.
Yeah, I'm really serious. I think that's a good idea.
Just talking? Well, what's the show about?
It's about nothing.
No story?
No, forget the story.
You gotta have a story.
Who says you gotta have a story? Remember when we were waiting for that table in that Chinese restaurant that time? That could be a TV show.
And who's on the show? Who are the characters?
I could be a character.
You?
Yeah, you base a character on me.
So on the show, there's a character named George Costanza?
Yeah. What, there's something wrong with that? I'm a character. People are always saying to me, you know, you're quite a character.
Seinfeld from 1992. Let's go to Narni, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Narni, can you wait for Seinfeld to show up on your Netflix queue?
I can absolutely not wait. I was born in 1994 and would get my homework done from 6 to 7 every night so I could watch, you know, TBS, Seinfeld, and Fox. And I am so grateful because I think it's completely informed my sense of humor and was probably my first point of similarity with my boyfriend that we really bonded over. And we try and see who can quote the most Seinfeld. And we often have competitions about who can make a Seinfeld connection the fastest when we're in a situation. So love Seinfeld, cannot wait for it to come to Netflix.
Well, and as you pointed out, they grabbed it from Hulu. So we'll talk about sort of the wars between these major streaming services in a few minutes. But before the break, let's go to, and Narni, thank you for your call. Let's go to Miriam, who's calling from New Orleans. Miriam, you're on the air.
Hi. My husband and I have been watching Seinfeld on Hulu. We started rewatching a month or so ago, and as we've been made our way through the seasons, we've just sort of been reflecting on how brilliant the writing was, because it was groundbreaking at the time. I think one of the first shows to sort of have a storyline or multiple storylines that sort of intersected at the very end of an episode for a huge payoff or punchline, and then sort of have seen shows like that come out, even in drama, having intersecting storylines come out in sort of the end of one episode to all tie together, and especially the trajectory of the careers of the actors.
Yeah.
I think it's like different from Friends a little bit, because the Friends actors had a lot more like sort of pop cultural recognition, but I feel like the Seinfeld actors had like real sort of career success in terms of the trajectory of their careers. I mean, you know, Julia Louis-Dreyfus has won like multiple Emmys, and you know, they've all sort of except for Michael Richards, I guess, have all had really good success.
Yeah. Well, Miriam, thank you so much for your call. And I think poor Michael Richards got trapped in the brilliance of his own performance on Seinfeld there. But we are talking this hour about the surge of nostalgia TV on streaming services, on every device that you've got, and why people seem to be really loving rewatching these shows from the 90s. We've got this comment on our website from Toyota, who says, "The theme song of Friends seems more appropriate now than it was back then. More jobs are jokes, lots more students broke, and Tinder is no place for a love life." We'll go out with Will Smith and The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. This is On Point.
And when I came out, there was a dude looked like a cop standing there with my name out. I ain't trying to get arrested yet, I just got here. I sprang with the quickness like lightning disappeared. I whistled for a cab, and when it came near, the license plate said fresh and it had dice in the mirror. If anything, I could say that this cab was rare, but I thought, man, forget it. Yo, home's the Bel Air. I pulled up to the house about 7 or 8, and I yelled to the cabbie, yo, home, smell you later. Looked at my kingdom, I was finally there to sit on my throne as the Prince of Bel-Air.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about streaming nostalgia today, and we've talked about Friends and Seinfeld showing up on streaming services like Hulu, Netflix, Warner as well. What about the ones that aren't just reruns, but like really different reboots, like that Beverly Hills 90210 reboot or the Very Brady renovation on HGTV? Joined today by Eric Deggans. He's the NPR TV critic. He's with us from St. Petersburg, Florida. And Crystal Antonia Russell joins us from San Diego, California. She's a professor of marketing at the Grazidio School of Business at Pepperdine University. And Eric, I just wanted to ask you sort of a business end question here, because I feel like the numbers that these streaming services are paying for these old shows, they feel really eye-popping, right? The $425 million that was paid for Friends, $500 million for Seinfeld. I mean, is it just... is that any different than how networks used to compete for syndication rights beforehand?
Well, again, you know, I'm always cautious about trying to make something that's been happening for a while look like it's this new thing. Of course, these numbers are huge, but you know, Seinfeld, according to one story I saw in Vulture, had already made $3.1 billion in syndication by 2014, before we were even talking about. Seriously talking about streaming.
Wow.
So this was a show that was already making a ton of money in syndicated reruns, you know, on conventional broadcast television stations across the country. Someone who had, you know, worked for the company that was syndicating it said they had underestimated how much money they were going to make on syndication on the show by 5 times. I mean, it was so much more popular than they expected. And you know, even in 2017, supposedly the show had made $4.06 billion in syndication. So, you know, in a way, these shows are earning the amounts of money that you would expect them to earn if their popularity kept increasing, which it seems like it has. So even though these numbers seem eye-popping, you know, popular shows that go into syndication have always commanded a lot of money.
Wow. Well, let's go to Carrie, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Carrie, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. I just wanted to put a plug in for Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which is the 90s show that I am rewatching. I watch it on DVD, although I think it was also on Hulu recently, and that I would just consider it sort of like a dark twist on Friends. You have outcasts mm-hmm. and queer women and monsters and people fighting evil and suburban boredom. And I find it to still be a really relevant show for the times that we're in now.
Yeah. Carrie, thank you for your call. Buffy was a really groundbreaking show back in the day, if I can say. But thank you so much for your call. Professor Russell, we have some interesting comments coming in online here via Facebook. For example, Olivia Montez wrote us and she said, I have anxiety. I'm a military wife. My life is always changing. I cling to my routines. When I can't sleep, I turn on shows like Friends, a show I grew up with, ritually watching weekly in the beginning. They are a lovely friend at 2 a.m. when everything else seems so overwhelming. And then following up with that, Casey Promise Thompson says, it's true. If I've got some panic coming on, I throw on some Golden Girls. It helps me get to sleep, too. Does nostalgia perform a therapeutic function for people?
Yes, it does. Not only nostalgia in general, but this nostalgia through these friends. Friends is a show that's very well titled because these become like your real friends and they're always there for you. And you have this connectedness to them that is like, you know, calling your best friend in the middle of the night just for support. They're always going to deliver. They're always going to be there. And on top of it, you have control over when you actually get to see them and hear from them. So, no doubt, it relieves stress, anxiety. It's this notion of comfort food that we talked about earlier. And you know it's going to deliver because you've watched it before. So you know it's a guaranteed feel good. Otherwise, you wouldn't reach out for it.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the phones because this really touched a chord in folks. And by the way, I'm waiting for the person to call in, if you can get through, who's brave enough to say these shows do not deserve a second life in our world today. So 800-423-8255. Let's go to Taylor, who's calling from Lafayette, Louisiana. Taylor, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi. So earlier you had mentioned how you thought maybe at first we didn't view some of these shows with a critical eye. Maybe we just had like rose-colored glasses, and now that we can put them all together. Anyway, I think that maybe we did have a very good critical eye and realized what we had at the time, and now that what's available on cable television consists of sensationalism, reality TV, the Learning Channel doesn't have learning programs, Discovery Channel either, you know, it's like we're at a loss for what we used to have in terms of quality, and streaming services have stepped it up in terms of their, you know, fictional, like, programming, things like Friends and...
Yeah.
Other programs like that, but...
Taylor, let me jump in here, because I think you told our phone screener that you liked The X-Files.
I do. I love it. I'm almost done watching the very last season that came out in the reboot,
yeah,
which I'm not really a fan of.
Me neither.
So
I was obsessed, obsessed with The X-Files. It was like my Friday night date. I didn't go out. I just got my popcorn and watched, you know, Fox Mulder and Dana Scully. But Taylor, thank you so much for your call. Eric, what do you think about Taylor's, you know, basic critique? He's saying that TV was just better back then.
I think what Taylor is really saying is that he liked the TV, the kind of TV that was available in the 90s more than he likes the TV that's available now. Because I think it's hard to make the argument that shows like Fleabag or A Handmaid's Tale or Stranger Things. It's hard to make the argument that those shows are somehow less of lesser quality,
right,
than the stuff that was on the air in the 90s.
Look, people,
it's just not true. I was covering television then,
yeah,
and believe me, there was nothing as good as those shows, or very little that was as good as those shows on the air back then. What I will say is that we were trying to deconstruct some of the stuff that was being talked about on Friends and Seinfeld and some of these shows, but when your perception changes in terms of what mainstream society accepts and how we all talk about these issues, when that changes, you know, there were those of us who tried to talk about how, you know, frankly, awful some of the people on Friends were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look at what they actually do, but it's easier to have that conversation now that we have some distance and now that we have changed how we feel about things like, you know, gender rights and rights for you know, recognizing the struggles of marginalized people. We're a little better on those issues now, and it's a little easier to look back and understand that.
I was just going to jump in and say, you know, there have been a million conversations in the past, you know, 10 years or so about how we've been in a golden age of TV very recently. And I would agree. I mean, I think what we had and are getting served to us now is amazing. But, you know, Professor Russell, let me ask you, like, I'm a big fan of Breaking Bad. I think it's one of the best TV shows I've ever seen. But I don't think I'm going to feel nostalgic about it 25 years from now, because it's one of those contemporary shows that really make you work hard. And that's good. Like, I like working hard as a viewer, but it's not a feel-good 90s sitcom. So, like, nostalgia sort of has its limits in terms of the kind of content that triggers that feeling.
Yes, but you may not want to rewatch Breaking Bad for nostalgic purposes, but you may want to rewatch Breaking Bad for reconstructing and looking at it from a different lens. Like, maybe there's such, it's such a complex show that maybe there's some, you know, details about, you know, the way the show is developed, the way the characters develop, that watching it a second time, and I find this in my research on reconsuming, that you reconstruct emotionally how you felt, you know, psychologically how you interpret characters, and then socioculturally, like we were talking about, how it's a time and place for a particular show, but if you rewatch it later, you're like, oh wow, you know, these were the days, kind of thing. So I think there's always a reconstructive part. It's always a subjective experience, and whether you rewatch it tomorrow versus 10 years from now versus 25 years from now, this reconstruction is always going to bring something new to the experience.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Sarah.
Go ahead.
One
other thing that's interesting to me is that, you know, TV back then was also often very segregated.
Yes.
And what's interesting to see is that the nostalgia is also becoming a bit segregated. There are people out there who are nostalgic for Living Single and In Living Color and Martin, some of the black-centered comedies that were actually programmed by Fox as counter-programming against the must-see TV shows like Friends and Frasier and Seinfeld, which were incredibly white and presented sort of very diverse urban areas like New York City and Seattle as almost devoid of people of color. So it's also been interesting to see how the nostalgia can be a little segregated as well. And we should definitely talk about some of these great shows from the 90s that featured black casts and non-white casts that some people are nostalgic for, too.
No, I actually really appreciate that you mentioned that, Eric, because one of the things that crosses my mind as I see some of these 90s shows again is those shows would never be written that way today because of the recognition of how, you know, exclusively white characters in a very rarefied, you know, socioeconomic status just doesn't really work for today's audiences. So go ahead, Eric, yeah.
Well, I was going to say there was in 1999, there was this watershed moment in network television where in the top four networks, Fox, ABC, NBC and CBS, every new show they created did not have a significant character of color in the cast. Four networks. Mm-hmm. It was something like 24 shows. It was a huge scandal. The NBC, the NAACP threatened to sue the networks, and it created all of these diversity executive positions at the networks and this real recognition at the broadcast networks that they had to make their cast more diverse. And nowadays you will notice you will not see a new show on the broadcast networks, at least, that doesn't have a character of color of significance in the cast, particularly because of what happened in 1999. So we're being nostalgic for these shows that were before that time. When broadcast television was really struggling to be representative of the diversity of America at that time.
Let's sneak in another call here. Paul is calling from Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. Paul, you're on the air.
Hello. Yeah, I just had a comment on the very Brady renovation tied in with Property Brothers.
Yeah.
I had been reading about how HGTV had thought this was going to be, you know, just a huge success, and they overpaid for the house, and I was reading about how the cast was involved, and so I tried the first episode, and for me, when viewing it, it just seemed to fall flat, and that the characters are, you know, there was one episode or one part of the show where Marcia had to approve the couch texture that was scanned by Jonathan from Property Brothers, and this is all wrapped around an occasional flashback that, for me, just there's no story here. I already know that Property Brothers can, like, restore the house perfectly, even though it was never a house. It was a,
it was,
know,
a
created
set. That's right.
Yeah. And, but there's no surprise. It's just kind of like, yeah, it's all Brady, but it's like, where's the content?
Right. Paul, thank you so much for your call. So the very Brady renovation maybe doesn't work as a renewal of an idea, but I do want to play one that I think it does work really well, because we got to talk for a second about the 90210 reboot. It's called BH90210, and here's a clip from the first season of it featuring the cast members from the original 90s Fox drama, and you're going to hear Jason Priestley and Jenny Garth sitting at a bar reminiscing about the past.
People see me and they think I'm Kelly Taylor, or I'm no one. They have no idea who I really am.
I know who you really are. You're Jenny Garth, the smart, fierce woman I went to work with every day for 10 years.
You were there for 8.
Technically, I left 4 episodes into the 9th season, but that's not the point. Jen, not to objectify you, because I know you hate that.
You do?
Yeah, I do. But I see you. All of you.
Jason Priestley and Jenny Garth in BH90210. Professor Russell, I love this idea, right? The cast comes back as themselves making a reboot on the show. That is the reboot of the show.
Yeah. It's brilliant. It's brilliant because you couldn't have it the other way where they're still themselves. Like, people would just not want to see that. So now you're giving a totally different lens on this. So instead of letting people, what's called, transport themselves narratively into those characters that they were in the 90s, 90210, now you're moving yourself out and you're seeing this as like, okay, that was a fabrication. Now let's take a more critical lens on this and think, okay, these are actors playing roles. And it gives a whole different dimension to the experience that I think is a brilliant idea.
Eric, we've got about 30 seconds. Just your quick take on BH90210.
I wish the writing had been sharper and funnier.
Ever the TV critic.
The concept was great. The concept was great, but the execution to me was sorely lacking, and I had a hard time watching it.
Honestly, Eric, I appreciate that. No, you know what? Never drop your standards just because we're talking about nostalgia. Eric Deggans.
I know. It's always my job to be the crank. Back in my day.
Got to aim for greatness every time. Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic, speaking to us today from St. Petersburg, Florida. Eric, thank you so much. It was great to have you.
Thank you.
And Crystal Antonio Russell, professor of marketing at the Grazidio School of Business at Pepperdine University, with us from San Diego, California. Professor Russell, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
And we will end this hour on streaming nostalgia with Where You Lead by Carole King from the Gilmore Girls. This is On Point.